And the real meaning of the real meaning, the real problem is this. The capitalist system requires the free flow of credit. It's part of the cycle, the normal cycle of capitalism, which, by the way, can be broken at any number of different points. It is wrong to pick one point and say, this is the thing, this is the... No, not so. There are any number of points where you can start a crisis. And, of course, it requires the free circulation of credit as lifeblood. Everyone knows this. Small businessmen know this. Even private persons are aware of this. And this collapse of the speculative boom must mean now, and it does mean, a contraction, a drastic contraction of credit. It must do so. Of trillions, of many trillions of dollars. This is hard to imagine, the consequences. It does have an effect. The IMF, again, you can't, nobody knows, but there are estimates. The IMF estimates that the banks in America and Europe alone will shed assets worth 10 trillion. Which is 14.5% of the total stocks of credit. This is it. That's why the banks won't lend, and they don't know how much. Nobody knows which bank has got what debts, because it's all being consumed. It's a form of theft. It's a form of swindling. I know it's not correct to say scientifically that property is theft. Proudhon was wrong about that, but there's a large amount of theft involved here. Speculative theft. This is massive swindling. Nobody knows the extent of this. Nobody knows. But what it certainly means is that the credit in the US, no matter how much money they throw at the banks now, the banks don't want to lend to each other because they don't know, well, if I lend money to this other bank, who's to say? It might go under, I might not get my money back. And nobody knows the extent of this. That's the problem that they face. So, if, according to the calculations of the IMF, the growth of credit in the USA will still grow to some extent, will slow to 1% next year. Now, what does that mean? 1% per annum, and God knows how long this will continue. The post-war average is 9%, to give you an idea. Now, this is serious stuff, and this certainly affects the real economy. That alone will be a massive drag. Now, in addition to this, of course, the collapse means a collapse of house prices. It means that millions of people are threatened with losing their homes, not just in America, but in Britain. This will happen. Found the consequences, both on economics and on politics and social reasons. And you see, it's so staggering, isn't it? It's so blatant, it's so appalling that the rich, the bankers, they demand money with menaces from the taxpayer, from the government. They say that they're making a sacrifice. We must all make a sacrifice. You see, yes, but there's a slight difference, isn't there, between sacrificing a few billion dollars in bankers' profits. Sacrificing your job, your home, your livelihood, your life. That's the way that you must. And this must have a profound effect both in Britain, the United States, and in America. Now, the basis of this boom, why it was kept going, was on the basis of a massive consumer boom in the USA. And incidentally, let's be clear about this. The bourgeois can only realize surplus value if they find a market for their commodities. That's ABC. Anyone can understand that. If there's no market, you don't sell the goods, then there's no good. It doesn't matter how much you try to extract surplus value, you won't get a red cent. And therefore, this question of demand is extremely important. That's the point. I won't have said about the collapse of the banks. I think I've said sufficient about that. But the main thing is that the bourgeois are in a state of panic. They're in a blue funk everywhere now. Because they don't know how this is going to end. They argue that without this intervention, this massive amounts of money, 2.5 trillion, there would have been a complete collapse, which is probably true, but they won't prevent the collapse in any case. There's a chain reaction now, in which everything will be dragged down. It's an actual fact that the banks now, can only survive, everywhere, can only survive on the if they lean on the crutches of the state. Handouts for the state. Now this is going to have very, very serious effects indeed. Now the bourgeois, in the 12 months ago they were concerned about inflation. They don't know what to think. They were worried about inflation 12 months ago. Now they're concerned about deflation, and I think that's right. If you enter into a downward spiral, there must be a downward spiral also of prices, profits and everything else. A slump in demand, which already exists, because this has been exhausted. A slump in demand will produce falling prices. How are you going to sell the goods unless you discount massively? I've got the figures of car sales and so on. I'll deal with that in a minute. I think the car sales in America, I think, are now the lowest in 16 years. General Motors has already suspended its operations in Europe. Why? To reduce output. They must slash output because they can't sell the goods, for goodness sake. What Marx meant when he said that the narrow confines of capitalism are too narrow to contain the enormous productive potential of the productive forces. Slump in demand produces falling prices, excess capacity. People postpone their purchases. You see that in housing now. Who's going to buy a house now when you think it's going to fall further? You're not going to buy this now. Which causes a further fall in the house prices. And in other words, you have here a downward spiral. The heaviest effects, by the way, will be felt with those countries with the biggest debts, and that includes Britain with its colossal debts. And I repeat, nobody knows where it will end. It's a bit like 1929. If you read Galbraith's book, quite an interesting book, every 2 minutes they were saying, well, it's finished now, we've bottomed out now, the crisis reaches, it can't get any worse than this. They thought that at the time of Bear Stearns, which is when? 9 months ago, can't remember, seems like 100 years ago. Every time they say that, it's just a prelude to a further massive fall. That was the case in 1929, it's the case now, and nobody, I repeat, knows where this is going to, where this is going to end. The injection of $2 trillion has not stopped the fall on global markets. It continues to fall. Commodity prices are now falling. Oil is now falling. Although I don't see much reflection of that in the petrol pump. They must be making a big killing. Oil is falling. I remember exactly 12 months ago, I was writing the draft of the World Perspectives document, and I put in a statement that oil has now reached the astonishing price of $80 a barrel 12 months ago. And that seemed like a lot. Then subsequently it reached over 140. Now it's fallen back again to 80 or below 80 now. And people breathe a sigh of relief. 12 months ago, $80 a barrel seemed a colossal amount. Now it seems like peanuts. Russia will be affected. The Russian bourgeois, they were so smug. We're all right, we got oil. Now it's collapsed, with immediate effects on the stock exchanges, a 20% drop on the stock exchanges in Moscow and St. Petersburg. They had to close the Moscow Stock Exchange. I think it's still closed because of the turbulence. Steep falls also in Asia. Asia was... They keep contradicting themselves. First of all, Asia was going to save them. You know? Then they said, the slump in America... first of all, they denied that there'd be a slump in America. Then when there was a slump, it was carved on their nose. They said, no. But it'll only be in America. America's decoupled. There's decoupling now, you see. Despite the fact that it completely contradicts everything they said for the previous 30 years about globalization. It's nonsense. On the contrary, the steep falls in Asia. Japan, the Japanese economy is in a particularly dangerous state. But there's been falls everywhere. The steep falls. The stocks in Japan, Hong Kong, Indonesia. They had to close the stock exchange in Indonesia. And this is despite the fact of this colossal injection. This is after the injection of $2 trillion and a 0.5% cut in interest rates. By the way, they made strenuous efforts to combine, for the first time ever, America, the European Union, Britain, of course, Canada, Sweden, China, Switzerland, Hong Kong, South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, all cut interest rates. What was the effect? Nothing. Further collapses, further falls, steep falls. And the reason for that, this collapse of confidence, the famous confidence, is what I said. That the bourgeois now understand perfectly well, there's no getting away from this, that they're heading for a deep recession on a global scale. Nothing can stop it. And therefore, that's the reason for these falls. The falling house prices and so on aggravates the crisis, not the cause of crisis. But the contraction of credit undoubtedly contributes to producing a vicious downward spiral, which can drive, which will drive, in my opinion, will drive the world into recession in the next few months. As a matter of fact, in some senses, it's a worse situation than the 1930s. I think that's what they're so concerned about, because the level of private sector debt is much higher now than what it was then. It's a lot higher. And what is at the bottom of this, which they don't talk much about this, they keep quiet about it, but what is really concerning the serious economists is the threat of protectionism. You see, we had an argument years ago with the Turkish comrades about globalization. They said it was fixed for all times, it couldn't be reversed. We said, on the contrary, it certainly can be reversed. And although they haven't yet fallen into, I noticed that the Doha world trade negotiations, have again failed. There can't be some agreement. And there's no doubt that once this begins to, this is not the end of the recession, it's only the beginning. It can last for some time. It's impossible to be precise about this. Once it gets a grip, there will be protectionism, quite clearly. It will be every man for himself. And of course, suddenly it's like a drunk that wakes up with a bad head and says, I'll never do this again. It's quite amusing. Bush actually said, I think he thought the microphone was switched off, he actually said words to the effect that Wall Street got drunk, quote and unquote. Wall Street got drunk. What he meant by that is there's a colossal increase in fictitious capital. Now, that's another element. Which, by the way, the irony is that this famous derivatives market was supposed to be a safeguard against this. It was supposed to safeguard against the big losses. You spread the risk. That was the argument. What's the business in now? Again, all these figures are quite eye-watering figures. Look, 10 years ago, the total value, the notional value of all outstanding global contracts of the, were amounted to $75 trillion. That's quite a lot, isn't it? Which was 2.5 times total world GDP. That was 10 years ago. You know what the figure is now? The figure at the end of 2007 was $600 trillion. I mean, these are the figures that you can't comprehend. Which is 11 times world output. That's the crazy situation that the bourgeoisie found. Compared to these figures, the couple of dollars that Bush and Brown have put into the economy are just peanuts. If you add to that, there's something called credit default swaps, which I don't even understand what it means, really. That market is 55 trillion only. 55 trillion. This is fictitious capital on an absolutely massive scale, which must be squeezed out of the system. The problem is, it's a bit like a junkie when your body's full of drugs and you're on a high for a long time. You try coming off the drugs, and you know what will happen. You'll enter into convulsions, and the system will enter into convulsions. The levels of debt, as I say, are higher than what they were in the 1930s. U.S. household debt in 1986 was 80% of disposable income. That's to say, for every dollar that was earned, 80 cents was debt. 2000, it arrived at 100%. And at the present time, it's 140%. That's to say, in America, for every dollar that is earned, $1.40 is owed. The position for Britain is worse. The position for Britain, I keep on correcting this figure because it's higher every time I see it, is apparently 172%. In other words, for every pound that is earned in Britain, £1.76 is debt. And the most amazing figure was Germany, which is 101%, which is astonishing given the traditions of the Germans. I've said something about commodities. I won't deal with that for lack of time. Much more that could be said. Now, they're all alarmed. All these gangsters now are thoroughly alarmed. And therefore, they try to reach a deal to pump money in. I've got the figures here. No, I won't repeat them. Commies know that. France, $360 billion. Germany, $500 billion, and so on. It's had no effect. There's no real effect in detaining this course, and it won't have any effect. In addition to that, of course, this recession, and it's only just started, doesn't just threaten the livelihoods of families. Families will go bankrupt. Firms will go bankrupt. Firms are going bankrupt. There's a wave of bankruptcy in America at the present time. And big firms are going under, like Lehman's brothers. Whole nations can go bankrupt. A whole nation has gone bankrupt in Iceland. It's only a small nation, but it has an effect in Britain. More of that is going to come. And growth in Europe, of course, is Europe is in recession. The key European economies are already experiencing negative rates of growth. Spain, I think, is stagnating. Now, you see, all of this has consequences. I've got a lot of more material there, but I don't have time to do it. What we must focus on is not the technicalities. We're not much interested in the technicalities of the business cycle. Not any. We're in it now. We're in the middle of it. What is important is the social and political and psychological effects. And what this will mean, what will it mean when people see, oh, incidentally, I don't know if you noticed that, another detail. The United States, they've got a sign, a neon light sign indicating the debt of the total debt of the United States. They have to put another digit on. It's now, what, 10 trillion? Over 10 trillion. Which is absolutely astonishing. This affects the real economy, as I've said. Chrysler, was the third biggest company, lost $400 million this year. It's technically bankrupt. G&M and Ford's are in a similar position. And of course, if there's a crisis, because people can't buy cars, people can't get credit to buy cars. That's finished. If you can't sell cars, what effect does that have? Not just in the car industry. There will be closures, massive closures, layoffs, sackings, and so on. That's without a shadow of a doubt. At the same time, it means less demand for steel, electricity, plastic, rubber, oil, petrol, you name it. Must be the case. And therefore, the question arises, I've got another thing, SAP, which apparently is the world's biggest maker of software for business, not home, has reported, quote, a very sudden and unexpected drop in demand. So that's it. That's the state of affairs. Japan shrank at an annualized rate of 3% in the second quarter. And of course the yen is increasing, so Japan is down the pan, basically. And they were looking to Asia, they were looking to Japan, and so there's bankruptcy in China also, but they don't report. Therefore, Asia will probably have some kind of a growth, lower growth, not an outright recession, but a low growth, less than 8% growth for China is a disaster, by the way. It's a disaster because they can't absorb the amount of people that are seeking work and so on and so forth, which would mean a colossal increase in the class struggle. Pakistan, by the way, is on the verge of a default. Zardari just went to Beijing to ask for money. The Chinese won't give him much money. They'll give him something, keep him happy. But there can be a default in Pakistan. And then the other defaults of major nations, not just Iceland, big nations can be faced with the default. Now, all this will mean what? Oh, here's a quote from the FT, 14th of August. When no one spends, no one buys. Clear enough, isn't it? And the economy ultimately grinds to a halt. Quite clear. You do not have to be an economic genius to work out the consequences. The classic vicious circle of rising unemployment, failed consumer spending, bankruptcy and business restructuring, leading to higher unemployment and even lower confidence. The famous confidence. Here in this statement, it comes last, which is the correct way of putting it, you know. Companies, it says, are also likely to hold back on capital spending until they see what the repercussions are on the real economy, and that hardly creates growth. I think it's clear. I don't have to belabor the point. Therefore, we are facing another question. What consequences will this be? Now, in Britain is already in recession. Unemployment is 1.79 million, which is the highest since 1991. 1991, don't forget, was the height of the recession. I don't know whether it's correct to refer to the height of the recession or the depth of the recession, but it was serious anyway. And that figure, by the way, does not include job losses in the financial sector. Now, I'll remind you that the finance sector, the City of London, was Canary Wharf and so on, was supposed to save the British economy. You know, I remember a conversation I had with Bob years ago, Bob McKee. He said, well, I think in the event of a recession, this was probably 20 years ago, the south of England will be okay. Because of the finance, the services sector. But on the contrary, it's the finance and service sector which is the Achilles heel of the British economy, as Ted pointed out I don't know how many times. This recession will be different to previous recessions in Britain because it will hit London and the South particularly hard. I've got the latest figures for unemployment here. The North East, which is traditionally the black spot, is still the highest, 7.7%. But London's not far behind. Unemployment in London is 7.5%. And it'll get worse. These figures don't include the finance sector. The North, I just happened to see there's a piece on the television news about Grimsby in Yorkshire. They already went through restructuring because of the collapse of the fishing industry. Now they're based on food processing. There's 3,000 jobs in food processing. They're going to close a big, I've forgotten the name of it, a big food processing company with a loss of over 500 jobs. That's a body blow to a place like Grimsby. Now, the question is this. Gordon Brown has thrown all this money. He thinks he's really smart. He throws, over £400 billion, which he hasn't got. Didn't take that out of dig that out of his piggy bank. This is taxpayers' money. This is the state's money, but the state hasn't got this money. It's got to be borrowed. It's got to be borrowed mainly from abroad. And this money must be returned. That means a vast increase in public indebtedness. What does it mean in practice? They're all cheering now and slapping Joe Gordon Brown on the back and so on and so forth. They'd be stabbing him in the back soon enough. What it means is clear: increased taxes and cuts, deep cuts in public spending. It must be. What else could it mean? Deep cuts in public. Although they're talking about it, the Keynesians, what clever people they are. The Keynesians now are advocating increased public spending. How are you going to get increased public spending? Now this raises a very interesting question. Consciousness is a very practical question. And millions of people, ordinary people, not just working class people, but middle class people will be asking a very good question. All right, I might be sacked next year. My factory is going to close. My workers are closed. How come you got these billions of dollars for the bankers, for the parasites of the city, and you can't nationalise, you can't save my industry? You can't save my job. They've offered peanuts. How much was it? 100 million? Something ridiculous. An insult for so-called retraining. What's the point of retraining when there are no jobs? Because of a systemic failure of capitalism itself. The figures for the profits of the bankers, I think you've seen. I don't know whether I should mention them. The NHS is starved of funds. There was a piece on the television about neonatal units for premature babies, which said that 55% of these units are temporarily closed, temporarily in inverted commas. So there's no money for this, no money for this. The real human tragedies and problems of ordinary people, but when it comes to the banks, Brown comes running with an open checkbook. And this, he's blind, Brown. He's still addressing all his speeches, not to the people, not to the enemy, but he's still addressing all his speeches to the bankers. He gave a speech the other day in Canary Wharf. He said the following, the man must be mad. He said, the city will come out of this stronger. London, in my view, is the great financial centre. Working with New York, of course, working with I don't see that changing, he says. The man is completely he's completely mad. Now, in effect, they've nationalised the banks. There was an interesting article. I wish I could quote all of this, but I've got it here somewhere. I can't find it, of course, from the Financial Times again, in which, of course, they try to avoid the word nationalisation. They avoid it like the devil avoids holy water. You can't mention it, like the Monty Python sketch. Don't mention the war here. Don't mention nationalism. By the way, what an irony. You remember, I think it was in 1986, was it the election, or 83? I can't remember. 1983. And they described the Labour Party's manifesto as the longest suicide note in history because it mentioned the possibility of nationalising the banks. I can't even remember what it did say. Not very much, I guess. And here you have not just Brown, but Bush nationalising the banks, and nobody bats an eyelid. You know, mustn't mention nationalisation. Alistair Darling now says, no, it's at arm's length, and we'll give it back as soon as possible, and we don't really want it like a hot potato. But nevertheless, the idea must dawn upon a worker, these workers in Grimsby that are faced with the factory closing. They must say, well, hang on a sec, if there's money to nationalise the banks, why can't you nationalise, to stop them from failing, why can't you nationalise my factory? In other words, that's why I said, the biggest danger that we face, comrades, is that we might be living in the past. We might be living We might be looking backwards, but we should not. We should look at the present situation and look at the future. And particularly to work out the way in which consciousness will be changed. Abruptly. You can have a situation, I'm certain of this, you can have a situation even now, where many middle class people, people that voted conservative, people that were Thatcherites, or non-political, you know, I'm non-political, that means I'm right-wing, you know, are thinking, questioning this. We had a comrade, I won't mention his name, a young comrade, who attended a public meeting last week where I spoke, and he said, my father owns a small taxi business, and he's going to go bankrupt. And in the past he didn't understand me when I was talking about politics and socialism, so, and now he's interested in discussing with me, he's interested in the idea of communism. And that's going to occur. Don't forget that Farrell Dobbs, the American SWP, started off as a Republican, he's a worker, but he voted Republican until the crisis jolted him out of that way of thinking, and that will happen in many cases. We've said this before, I've said it in the World Perspectives document, I think last 2 years ago, and that you can reduce this to an equation, and the equation is this: all attempts to restore economic equilibrium will destroy the political and social equilibrium. They're desperately trying to restore some kind of economic equilibrium at the cost of the masses, at the cost of the workers, at the cost of the middle class, at the cost of small businessmen, at the cost of the unemployed, at the cost of the old and the sick. And the blatant contrast between that and the treatment of the bankers, here we are. Michael Gian, how do you pronounce his damn word? I don't really care. The chairman of the HSBC, £3.5 million, of which £2.5 million in bonuses. Fred Goodwin, I can pronounce his name, of the Royal Bank of Scotland, £4 million, of which £2.8 million bonuses. And these gangsters, this is the most astonishing case. This is known, by the way. These figures have been published in the Metro, which everyone reads on the tube in the morning. They've been published on the television. People can see this. People know this in a way perhaps they didn't know in the past. The most scandalous case was in America. By the way, the last 5 years, the five biggest firms on Wall Street paid more than $3 billion to the top executive. $3 billion. To top executives in bonuses and so on. Lehman Brothers, which after all is a major firm, filed for bankruptcy on the 15th of September. That's, what, just a month ago? 15th. How time passes when you're enjoying yourself. And we've got the right to enjoy ourselves, after all. They filed for bankruptcy on the 15th of September, the biggest bankruptcy in history. $613 billion. Dollars of debt. At the same time, when they were pleading with the government for money, Richard Fuld, who's the chief the gangster in chief, got $484 million in bonuses and so on and so forth. And by the way, they were still dishing out money to the executives while they were pleading with money from the government. Again, this is known. I believe this is known. There's a congressional inquiry. But by the way, Fuld stands up, and it seems to be the fashion these days. If you do something wrong and you're caught out, you say, I accept full responsibility. Then you do nothing, of course. Like Blair, you know, the Iraq war. I accept full responsibility. Then you don't resign. You don't renounce your wages. You don't give up your house. But you accept full responsibility. The nadir of cynicism. The nadir of cynicism. This is known to people, and this must have an effect. And by the way, this is dangerous. You've got to think, I mean, you know, what Trotsky said, when all else fails, start to think. That's why you're born with a head on your shoulders. You know. Work it out. What effect do you think this is having on the consciousness of millions of people in America? It's not an accident that you had an unprecedented state of affairs. 1,000 American workers came on the streets to demonstrate when this $700 billion deal was being announced. Called a 2 days notice by the New York trade unions. That's an indication. And on the news, it struck me, very often you can learn more from a little anecdote than from reams and reams and reams of abstract statistics. Doesn't seem to mean very much. But when it's reduced to a human level, then it means a lot. They interviewed, it was Channel 4 News, they interviewed this American woman, and she was not a young woman. What do you think about this bailout of 700 billion? She answered in the following. She looked pretty tired. I noticed that. She said, look, I've just been working an 11-hour shift. I work 60 hours a week. I work hard. And now they want to take my money off me and give it to the bankers. What do you think I think of it? Millions of people are thinking about it. Also in Britain. Don't make no mistake about it. Also in Britain. We can make a big mistake if we just trundle along in the routinest manner, you know. Yesterday like today, today like tomorrow. Not so, my friends. Not so. Not so, comrades. Drastic times require drastic measures. Energetic measures. You know, routinism doesn't fit the bill at all. Because millions of people, now what they'll do is that they'll compare this obscene generosity to the bankers with the cuts, the tax increases, the lack of schools, the lack of houses, the lack of hospitals, the falling living standards, the austerity, because what this means is permanent austerity for the foreseeable future. For the foreseeable future, now you'll have a and they'll argue, oh, we require this in the national interest. Oh, that's another point. At this moment in time, when there's a big shift in consciousness in the lower layers of society, not just the working class, but the middle class, a shift to the left, people are even looking for the most radical things, because they will. People will say, look, this is a matter of life and death, which it is. This is not a small thing. When you're faced with losing your job, your savings, you're not even sure what's going to happen next week. The old security's gone. There was a time when people thought about a job for life. Many people thought that. They got a job for life. There is no job for life. Nobody is safe, including the middle class, which is faced with bankruptcy because of the banks. You know. They'd be wide open to radical sources. Precisely at this moment, all the labour leaders, with the exception of one or two honourable people like John McDonald, and even the what's his name? Robert Colin...
Bergen,
that's right. He made a good speech actually in the House of Commons. He said, look, he says, I sense the invisible hand of the market. That's the argument of Adam Smith, you know. I sense the invisible hand of the market in our pockets, and then afterwards putting two fingers up. Which is precisely what's happened. Because they haven't revived borrowing. There's been only a minor, marginal improvement. They're not giving mortgage. Who can get a mortgage now? Who can buy a house, which has profound economic consequences in deepening this downward spiral, and at the same time it's having political content. There's a swing to the left at the bottom of society. You've got to be blind not to see this. At the same time, there's a swing to the right at the top. They're all together like thieves, all together in the House of Commons. Liberals, Tories, Labour, so-called Labour, all together. Yes, we must. It's a crisis. It's like that. We must all pull together. We're all in the same boat, really. Really. By the way, you'd be hard pushed to find a boat now because it's a big crisis of the shipping industry, which reflects a sharp decline in world trade. Shipping industry, that's a symptom. As somebody said on the television, that's a key set of symptom to the state of the world economy when the shipping is in crisis. We're all in the same boat. We all defend the same interest, and this is true. All these leaders, Tory, New Labour, Liberal, do defend the same interest, not the interest of the masses on the ground, but the interest of the banks. And all rally around to protect the banks. That's what they say. People are not stupid, you know. People are not stupid. They can see this. And therefore, the old lethargy is gone. There's a profound change in consciousness. And people are open. I gave that little detail. The Das Kapital... is a bestseller in Germany, in East Germany. East Germany. I mean, we carried the piece on the website yesterday. People are saying, well, you know, socialism was not all that bad. And the idea of nationalization now, of course, will be very popular, actually, if it was raised. Oh, here's the quote I had from the Financial Times. A chap by the name of Philip Stevens says, forget the semantics, because they're all avoiding nationalization. Forget the semantics. This is a real bourgeois writing. Forget the semantics. All of Britain's banks are now dependent on the public purse. None of them would survive. We think we should publish this in the journal. None of them would survive 2 minutes without the panoply of government guarantees and access to almost limitless liquidity from the Bank of England. To all intents and purposes, the whole system has been nationalised. Yes, but it's not nationalised in the sense that we would advocate, and we have to explain that. You know, that we're not in favour of paying out lavish sums of money. People now will be open, I guarantee this. People, ordinary people, we're wide open to revolutionary ideas. That's what the point. Now, we've got, not just in Britain, I've concentrated heavily in Britain for obvious reasons. Take Italy. By the way, Italy and Britain are now the two sick men of Europe. They're all sick, but these are two particularly sick cases. And you can expect some big surprises. We must not compromise. We must not, under any circumstances, allow our consciousness to be affected by the long period when there was an absence of class struggle, a very low level of class struggle. This is going to change. To look no further, Iceland has collapsed. Many local councils have lost, I think the figure that sticks in my head is 850 million, but it must be more than that. And the government is not prepared to pay them. Not, they're prepared to pay the bankers, but they're not prepared to pay the local councils. This will mean, no matter what they say, many councils will find it difficult to pay for services, to continue essential services, to pay workers, you know, refuse collectors, street cleaners, school dinner ladies, whatever, you know, grave diggers. It's entirely possible, in my view, you think people are going to accept this lying down? It's entirely possible that in the next few months you can see a spate of strikes in the local government sector if they start playing around with that. Even the Economist understands this. I quote again from the latest editorial, Capitalism at Bay. Quote, talking about America first, it will be a brave president who goes to Detroit and explains why the 45,000 well-paid folk at Morgan Stanley should get $10 billion of taxpayers' money, but the 266,000 people at General Motors should not. Doesn't that put it very clearly? I think it puts it with admirable clarity. People will draw the conclusions, and therefore they'll be wide open. In Italy, for example, at the last elections, the Fondazione Comunista, which in effect is the Communist Party, was kicked out of the government. It's the first time, by the way, in the history of Italy, since it existed as an independent state, independent republic, first time in history that there is no communist or socialist party in the represented in the parliament. No. The PDS has gone over to the bourgeoisie, in effect. And you could draw pessimistic conclusions from that. You'd be wrong. As a matter of fact, that the RC benefited from that now. They benefited. They just had a demonstration in Rome, wasn't it? When was the demo? When? Last Saturday, exactly 1 week ago. Of 500,000 were called by the Reformation Communists, and 500,000 people turned up to the demonstration. 1,000 marched behind the banner of our comrades. 1,000 people marched behind our banner on that demonstration. And the reason is precisely they're outside the government. If they'd been in the government, they'd have got the blame for this. In other words, I repeat the point, people are beginning to draw, that's an exaggerated thought, but people are beginning to draw the most far-reaching revolutionary conclusions. And therefore, Thomas, purely for lack of time, I'll have to conclude. We don't have a lot of time to go into detail. We can do that through the journal, through other discussions at other levels and so on. But what is essential is that these should deal with the fundamentals, not be sidetracked into this question, that question, this detail, that. This is not the moment, my friends. Not the moment at all. Concentrate on the fundamental question. The fundamental question is clear. It's on the admission of the bourgeoisie themselves and their spokesmen. This is a very serious crisis, the like of which has not been seen since the 1930s. It is a crisis which this tendency predicted. That we prepared to open the books. You checked what we wrote over the years on this. It was delayed longer than what we thought. But for that very reason, it's a humdinger now. They pay the price for that. That's the other side of the coin. Nobody knows how long this is going to last, but it's going to last for some time. And the consequences of this, the psychological and political and class conscious, above all, will be tremendous. And therefore, comrades, this is our moment. This is an historic change. This is not a minor thing. This is our moment. This is the moment that we've been preparing for, comrades, in this room, have spent all their lives preparing for this. And therefore, we must seize it with both hands. We must seize it energetically. Believe me, that the message of this tendency, the ideas, the program, the method, will connect in a way, perhaps, that we've never connected since I've been in politics. We have the beginnings of serious forces. We must strengthen these forces. We must expand our babies. We must be bold, above all on recruitment. You can win over people to the ideas of Marxism now, not just young people, older people also. It can be won over, which you wouldn't have thought possible in the past. We must do this, comrades, because Britain and the world is now entering into a very decisive period. It won't be all easy. It won't be all honey and apples, as Ted used to say. A prolonged period of crisis, of capitalism, a period of revolution and counter-revolution, but in the course of which millions of workers will learn. Millions of people will draw the necessary conclusions which will enable us to construct a big, sizable organization, sizable tendency. First of all, in Britain and internationally, a sizable tendency which eventually will be in a position, will build the forces, will be in a position to lead the working class to the victory of the socialist revolution in Britain and on a world scale.